members of the American Institute of Architects, offering consumers a directory of its members and information on architecture, AIA.org.
I'm Alex Beam. This is The Connection. Birmingham, Alabama, the magic city. Its motto is, it's nice to have you in Birmingham, but it's also known as Bombingham. This is the city where writer Diane McWhorter grew up. She ate at the all-white country club where the big names gathered to maintain their hold over Birmingham. She was just 10 years old when a bomb down in the valley exploded in the 16th Street Baptist Church, killing four young black girls. That was in 1963, when the civil rights movement's mantra was, as goes Birmingham, so goes the South, and so did go the South. The explosion at the church bombed the feds into attention. It helped make the Civil Rights Act of 1964 a reality. But beyond the bombs and dogs, water hoses and white hoods lay a deep foundation of hatred and power. 10-year-old Diane didn't know much, but she knew that in her house, civil rights weren't welcome. 20 years later, she started researching her book with the fear that her own father may have been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Connection listeners, how did Birmingham speak to the nation in 1963? How does it speak to you now as jury selection proceeds in the trial of one of the alleged church bombers? Please give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, to join the Birmingham Connection, 1-800-423-TALK, or you can be part of this show at The Connection, one word, theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio by Diane McWhorter, the author of Carry Me Home, part memoir, part history of her upbringing in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome, Diane.
Hi.
Hi. I know we're going to talk about the bombing and the trial of the 16th Street bombers a little bit later, but I want to hear about your 20-year journey. Every book is a departure for a place. Tell us what hit you 20 years ago. Where did you want to go?
Well, I was growing up in Birmingham at the time of the church bombing and the huge demonstrations there in 63, and I was growing up in a place that was called Over the Mountain, which was a state of mind as well as a place. So I realized that I had no memory of learning about when the church was bombed. And even though I had total recall of the Kennedy assassination, which took place only 2 months later. And part of this was that I just didn't think it had anything to do with me and my people. And I always remember having a certain consciousness of it, but we never discussed it in the family. There was never a sense that if I had been the, quote, wrong color, it could have been me.
You know, but yet you had to go downtown to shop. There were fire hoses being used against your fellow citizens. How could you not perceive that?
We only knew what we saw on the evening news, and to tell you the truth, I don't even remember seeing that. The demonstrations that spring that you're referring to with the hoses and dogs were extremely contained, and I had never seen that historic part of the city until I was 27. And I was shocked when I found out that it was only four blocks away from where I had bought my Easter dress that spring. So that's how alienated we were from what was going on. And I guess part of, you know, my motive for doing the book was to try to figure out why I lacked any appropriate consciousness about this, and also to find out exactly what my family's connection to it was, because I had grown up thinking that we had no connection, that this was something that had just blown up in Birmingham, and pardon the pun, that, you know, that the outside agitators had come in and stirred up our happy colored people, and you know.
How did you set out to make that connection? Was it simply the matter of making a physical trip back home?
Actually, I was living here in Boston, and I had been working, I'd gotten my start in journalism at the Boston Phoenix, an alternative weekly, and the book review editor there had gotten the Alabama volume of a bicentennial series on the 50 states, and so he said, ooh, get this off my shelf, you know, and you're from the land of George Wallace, you've got to take it home. So took it home, didn't throw it away for some reason, and I was about to go back to Birmingham one time, and I opened it up, and I happened to read the very small, short account of Birmingham in 63, and it mentioned that there was only one white businessman who would let his name be used in negotiating with Dr. King in the spring. It was so controversial, and they were so afraid that they were going to do this, make the settlement in secret, and this one man stood up and said, I'm a segregationist, but I'm not a damn fool. So I was reading this, and the man's name was Sid Smyer, and I screamed to my empty apartment in Cambridge, "That's my cousin!" So that was the first time I ever realized this had anything to do with me.
Now, when you made your first trip back, your own family plays a huge role in this book, and a fascinating one, because they're sort of good white people. They did live in the Mountain Brook District, I think it's called, over the mountain from Birmingham. Did you phone your family and say, "I'm coming home and I want to interview all of you"? How did they react to your quest?
Well, the community as a whole, my friends, my family, at first said, "Well, why would anybody want to read a book about Birmingham?" But my father, who became the sort of central figure of the family in the book, because I was really trying to figure out how he had come from this Ivy League educated country club family and had turned into this kind of vigilante spirit. And he went out at night going to what he called civil rights meetings. I was concerned that he was going to do something violent and illegal. And that had been a source of great anxiety and shame when I was growing up. And I would have just died if anybody had known about that or known about my fears. So when I asked him, when I told him what I was doing, he knew immediately what I was doing and said, but he used the N-word, of course, and he said, "Oh, the N-word bit."
Huh.
And so that kind of sums up his attitude. It was like he really got it.
Now, I'm gonna break in here, mm-hmm. Diane, because not only is your father a key figure in your book, Carry Me Home, but we're honored to be joined now by the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who's one of the co-founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and is, in fact, according to your book, really the major organizer of the demonstrations in Birmingham. Welcome, Reverend Shuttlesworth.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Hi, Reverend.
Especially with Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
It's great to have you, Reverend. I read in Diane's book how Bull Connor tried to have you killed more than once, and I'm glad that it's he who's with his maker and you who's with us.
Yes, I've been saying before Diane's book that I thought I'd been in death jails 8 or 10 times, and her report showed that I've been in death jails almost 25 times. I'm not a cat of 9 lives, cat with 25.
I know they joked about you. There's a terrifying scene in Diane's book where a water hose slams you into the gutter.
Yeah, into the basement of the church. Policemen thought they should put some water on the reverend, they said. But God let me hear it from afar and look back and saw the water arching to me, just turned my face to the wall and threw my hands up, as my face would be ruined today. And there again, maybe that's the second or third time, I thought I was dying, and God said, "Not yet, not here."
Reverend Shuttlesworth, let me ask you, how could Birmingham be so starkly divided between two populations, the one that Diane describes and then the one that you led?
It's difficult for me to describe how it could be, except that men and women, unless they be inspired of God's righteousness and goodness, can be anything. Men can be angels, angelic in nature, or they can become beasts. And Birmingham, because of segregation, chose the beastly part. You know, segregation, as I understand it, at that time was more important to most white people than going to heaven. Many of them would have chosen to miss heaven if they had to lose segregation.
I think a lot of them did miss heaven because of segregation.
Well, I pray that they didn't. You know, I'm nonviolent. God said he didn't want anybody to be lost, and I hope the guy made it right with God before they went home, even George Wallace and Bull Connor.
Well, we'll all find out about that. I'm going to ask Diane a quick question, Reverend Shuttlesworth, because she writes in some detail about your relationship with Dr. Martin Luther King, who really was coming to Birmingham from somewhere else. What's that about, Diane?
Well, my contention is that we might not be celebrating a national holiday for Dr. King right now, today, if it hadn't been for Reverend Shuttlesworth.
You wouldn't.
Oh, Reverend, let me say that.
Thank you. I don't want to preempt you.
If you've done it, right. It ain't boasting.
Yeah. Well, coming into Birmingham, Dr. King had been really passive and unfocused. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which he and Reverend Shuttlesworth had founded in 1957, was going nowhere slowly. And King really dreaded Birmingham as this destination. It was so dangerous. And Shuttlesworth kept saying, "You've got to come into Birmingham. You've got to face the lion in his lair, Bull Connor." And it was really through Shuttlesworth's goading that movement ended up there, and then, of course, it became the turning point.
Reverend Shuttlesworth, what are your feelings today about Dr. King and his role in the Birmingham demonstrations?
Well, I think Dr. King was God's spokesman to the United States and our generation. He was a warrior, but his basic thing was to sort of get people to understand the need for the movement, which they didn't really understand, to speak to them and remind them that God was still saying something to the nation, that his word ought to be heard and obeyed, and if you didn't, you'd have trouble. And then to try to teach us that nonviolence is the way. You see, the word has to live in us. You have to really try to live what you say you believe, and that's the hypocrisy of Birmingham. And I think the church was one of the greatest greatest groups that really sponsored the segregation. They just felt as if they could praise God on Sunday and work with the devil on Monday, I guess.
That's a terrible irony, of course. I have a question for you, Reverend Shuttlesworth. Another terrific set of details in Diane's book is all the pressure that was put on you not to demonstrate, not to act. Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, even Martin Luther King felt that maybe you shouldn't take this particular battle to the streets.
And your question is, why did I do it?
Yeah.
Because God told me to do it. In faith, by faith. And what God says, you should... Well, the early church gave me my slogan, we ought to obey God rather than man.
Right. How was nonviolence a successful strategy against a man like Bull Connor, who clearly hadn't taken the same vows that you took?
Well, nonviolence said to the nation, and we'll be studying it for a long time to come because we don't learn too much from history, that you have to really suffer for what you believe. You have to be willing to pay for it with your life if necessary, because life really belongs to God. And if we make this life one of trying to achieve justice and brotherhood and what God really wants, then you'll enter into a larger life. There is no death. Death has little meaning to God. It's tragic for us if we don't choose life.
Reverend Shuttlesworth, I know we're going to lose you soon, and I'm sorry about that. Could you tell us very briefly why you're in Birmingham now?
A young man named Jeff Steinberg has taken a sabbatical from teaching, and he brings 100 or more children at a time here just to go through the South and see these places, and especially Birmingham, and he invites me down because they think I'm the epitome of struggle in Birmingham, I guess, like Bull Connor was the epitome of segregation. And so Bull,
it's all too true, Reverend.
Wait, I didn't hear you.
I said it's all too true.
Well, I don't call myself a hero. I don't call myself a great man. I do want to be a servant of God, even now. And I still want people to be committed to getting rid of injustice in this world, whatever it takes.
Well, thank you for doing that work, Reverend Shuttlesworth, and thank you for joining us here in Boston. God bless you, and thank you for fighting that fight. Connection listeners, when we come back, please call us, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You've been listening to The Connection on NPR.
Jailhouse bound, you're jailhouse bound. Tell all your friends,
including the Louvre in Paris and the Prado in Madrid, online at museumshop.com. The time is 10:22.
The immortal voice of the notorious Bull Connor, Birmingham's Commissioner of Public Safety from 1963 and before. So, Diane, did the McWhorters know Bull Connor?
They didn't know Bull Connor, but they knew the people who put Bull Connor in power. They knew them well. One thing that I was doing in my sort of personal quest in trying to figure out my father was, you know, I was trying to figure out how he had evolved from this background, evolved so strangely. But what I ended up realizing was that the family, which I thought had nothing to do with Birmingham, turned out to be a metaphor for Birmingham. That my father was sort of expressing somewhat crudely the values of his community in the same way that people like Bull Connor and also the Ku Klux Klan were reflecting the values of the
Connection
the
listeners.
City establishment.
Connection listeners, join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the Birmingham 1963 connection with my guest, Diane McWhorter, author of the book Carry Me Home, which partly involves her childhood in fifth grade in 1963 in Birmingham. You talk about the Ku Klux Klan, Diane, and in fact, you devote a considerable amount of attention to the extremely complicated sociology locally of the Ku Klux Klan. And as you know, we have an extremely one-dimensional view of them here north of the Mason-Dixon line. Can you elaborate on who they were?
Well, starting out in the 20s, they were the sort of middle class, more of a middle class movement. That was the big renaissance of the Klan following its death after Reconstruction. So, and what I learned to my surprise was that I was really confused about how the Ku Klux Klan could have produced a politician like Hugo Black, who was, you know, became the most sure. active civil libertarian on the Supreme Court. What I finally realized was that at the time, the Ku Klux Klan was the insurgent liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Believe it or not, that if you removed race from the equation, then and you looked at all their positions on economics and everything, they were the liberals. So that explained it. Were they
pro New Deal reformers?
No, this was in the 20s, and then what ended up happening was that. Birmingham was this very industrial, heavy manufacturing mecca. It was conceived to be the savior of the New South, to move the South from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy.
Right, had the incredible steel mill with the statue of Vulcan looking down.
Right, exactly. So the industrialists were always trying to figure out ways to co-opt the workforce. So they saw the Klan as a good way to do this because. The Klan in the 20s was really focused on Catholics, which meant Catholic ethnic immigrants who were in the workforce.
When you say focused on Catholics,
yeah.
you mean focused on beating up Catholics.
Or demagoguing against them and also committing some violence against them. But it was in Birmingham, believe it or not, it was mostly lip service. What ended up happening, though, was that the Klan became this really potent political force, elected these liberals like Hugo Black and also a governor named Bibb Graves. So then the big mules, that was the name given the big industrial interests, decided they had to put the Klan out of business. So they did that. Politically, they just quashed them through various machinations in the electoral law. So the Klan comes back in the 30s as an anti-New Deal union-fighting machine.
Oh, right.
What I kind of wanted to do in the book was take these cataclysms in 63, the fire hoses, police dogs demonstrations, and then the church bombing, and sort of trace the roots of that back to the beginning. And where I found it really began in earnest was the New Deal, because you get these two really vibrant forces starting up there. First of all, the labor movement comes in because Birmingham is the proletariat center of the South, and also the Communist Party sets up headquarters there.
Now, we're still talking about whites only. Is that fair to say? The labor movement isn't particularly interested in unionizing blacks.
No, there's the rub. The United Mine Workers, which was strong in Birmingham, had been this biracial vanguard of the civil rights, of the labor movement. The rest of the labor movement, the AFL, which had been fairly lily white, realized that they were going to have to adopt what they call the UMW formula if they were going to succeed, because they had to organize across color lines. That was both the strength and what turned out to be the vulnerability of the labor movement, because it gave the employers an opening for demagoguing them to exploit the racism, that the pre-existing racism. So you have this progressive labor movement, and then you also have this really well-organized backlash, which consists of vigilantes like the Klan, and also vigilantes on the payroll, on the actual payroll of U.S. Steel, for example, beating up labor organizers. You have the big mules subsidizing anti-Semitic and racist propaganda to sort of foment this strife. And then you have the big mules looking around for, we need a political representative in City Hall. And they look around, and who do they find but this really popular baseball announcer named Bull Connor. So Bull Connor is installed in City Hall as this anti-New Deal mascot in 1937. So that's where it all began.
Now, I'm going to interrupt you. You write about both your father and your uncle. My memory tells me that your uncle was sort of a lawyer with ties to the big mules. Is that accurate? Did your family have people or legs in both of these camps?
Absolutely. My grandfather had been this Harvard-educated lawyer for the Alabama Power Company. He had been part of the anti-New Deal resistance. He had fought the Tennessee Valley Authority in court. His son, my Uncle Hobart, became a very well-known corporate lawyer in Birmingham. And his older brother, my father, took some weird course into downward mobility and hanging out at, beer joints playing dominoes.
Well, we're going to talk about your father a little bit later. Connection listeners, this is the Birmingham Civil Rights 1963 Connection. Feel free to join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Phyllis is calling us from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. I wanted to relate an incident that happened to me in 1974, which is, another 10 years after the period in which you're speaking. I was on a tour with a small chorus of Robert DeCormier singers, and our bus broke down in Birmingham. We had several African-American members and an African-American bus driver, and this guy got on the bus who was going to put us in the garage and said, we had a whole busload of old darkies who came through here last week. And I mean, we were just slack-jawed at this. And I'd never heard that word, even though I grew up in Texas.
This was a policeman who said that?
No, this was a guy who was working at the bus depot.
Oh, okay.
The supervisor or somebody at the bus depot. And I wonder, if that is so little that Birmingham had evolved by that point, how much has it indeed evolved by today's standards? It was a very upsetting incident for all of us on the bus, and he looked straight at the African-American bus driver and said this.
That's a great question, Phyllis.
Well, if we can, move next door to Mississippi for a second, you see in the flag referendum that took place yesterday, the rhetoric from the civil rights era is exactly the same. I mean, it's sort of like if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile stuff. So there's an argument to be made that the mindset is still very similar to what it was back then. But you have to admit, though, that they can't legally get away with it anymore. So that's a big change.
What would it be like, Diane McWhorter, if you and I went to Birmingham? For you, it would be coming home. But to follow up on Phyllis's experience 25 years ago, would there be elements of shock for someone like me who grew up in the Northeast?
Well, I'm a little bit shocked about that story because I think what you would observe and what most, quote, Yankees observe when they go down there is the amazing civility between and ease between the races. Now, believe it or not, that was sort of the case when I was growing up, except, of course, everybody, quote, knew their place. So, and one of the reasons people were so astonished that Birmingham got this terrible reputation is that, they really believe that everybody got along just great. And on the surface, it kind of looks that way.
Right. Phyllis, we're sort of curious, when you rode that bus into Birmingham, why were you so surprised in 1974? Do you really think history can do a 180 in 11 years?
Well, no, I think it was because I had been living in New York for about 10 years prior to that, and this was a group that was actually out of New York. It was not out of Texas. One gets the feeling in the Northeast that this sort of thing doesn't really exist anymore.
Right.
Well, I have to point out that 1974 was when Boston was going through its busing crisis.
Hey, so, wait a minute.
So it did sort of happen up here.
We're eager to talk about the mote in your eye, but we have no intention of elaborating on the beam in our eye, Miss McWhorter. Phyllis.
Also in Texas when I was growing up, there was a very similar atmosphere to everybody knowing their place and everybody thinking that everything was fine. I think that was probably the first time as an adult that I had really encountered open hostility because it had always been covert.
Well, let's be fair both to to Birmingham and to Diane McWhorter. It can happen anywhere. Phyllis, thank you so much for your call. We have now joining us on the line another character from the Birmingham 1963 drama, James Parsons. Welcome to the show, James.
Glad to be with you, Alex.
That's great. You're going to tell us a story that no one can tell us. You were a foot soldier. You were a policeman on the line in Birmingham in 1963.
That's correct.
What was that like?
Well, it was a very difficult time, and I can remember working 20 hours a day for, you know, months on end. You would guard churches and stuff at night, and then you would go and enforce the civil rights laws at the schools during the day, and it was really a difficult time for most of us in the department.
Now, just for context, you're painted in Diane's book as a dissident. You're hardly a Bull Connor man, and you later became the chief of police in Birmingham. Jim, back in 63, did you stand shoulder to shoulder with Ku Klux Klan members in that force?
Absolutely not. With the police department, there were three different groups. There were those that supported and benefited from the position held by Bull Connor, and there were those that were outside his group but would love to be in it. And then there was a small group that wanted no part of it, and I was part of that group, and we felt that our future did not lie in a department that was headed by a fellow like Bull Connor. And we actually kind of hitched our star to the civil rights movement, not for any, you know, high moral purpose, but just to get rid of that so that we could further our careers through the normal process.
Parsons and his group of fellow police officers were sort of instrumental too in helping get rid of Bull Connor. There was a progressive movement to abolish his office, and Chief was part of helped the forces of progress get rid of him by exposing corruption in the department and whatnot.
Yeah,
I want to ask you, Jim. The image of you is one that we've really only seen in Life magazine, a man with a helmet and a nightstick. What were your feelings? Are you a religious man? What was it like to be on the line against nonviolent demonstrations by American citizens?
Well, you know, that's another thing that when you're in the middle of that, those demonstrations, they were really not nonviolent. If they had been nonviolent, actually, it would have defeated itself. But what happened? There was violence on both parts, and actually, the press and the civil rights movement, you know, it was a scenario that had to be played out, and they portrayed themselves as nonviolent. But if you had asked a lot of the older citizens that were on the streets that were just knocked down, hips broken, and all of that, and students brought from out, you know, called out of school, you know, and there was a lot of violence on both sides.
I accept that.
And actually,
right.
it had to be, or it wouldn't have worked.
Gotcha. Jim, what's we read in the press here about this trial, which is almost like a horrifying, to use a poor choice of words, blast from the past. How is Birmingham reacting to the fact that 38 years after the fact, the two alleged bombers of the 16th Street Church are now going to trial?
Well, of course, everyone here hopes that that if the evidence indicates that there's guilt there, that, of course, the jury will react to that, and it will bring some finality to this. But the average man on the street, unfortunately, looks at this as a political power play by the different prosecutors and the different segments of government you know, and they're real concerned that these guys were like most Ku Klux Klan at that time. They simply ran around bragging about all the things that they did. I'm not saying they did or didn't do that. I remember them as small-time actors in the Klan at that time.
Jim, I want to just ask you, you devoted your career to law enforcement in Birmingham.
Yes.
How could we not have found two of the three men who bombed this church for 38 years?
Well, you have to think, you have to go back. First of all, at that time, the state of the art of evidence collection is nowhere near what it is today. And you had a tremendous explosion, which destroyed most of the evidence. And then you had this quasi-secret society that pulled it off. And, you know, like I say, I hope they've got the right ones. They're certainly going to have a trial to find out. But, you know, I look back at the real kingpins in that thing at that time, J.B. Stoner, and the Nazi party and all of that. And to this day, and even back then, I worked on those cases and signed people to them later on.
Chief, did you find evidence that some of your colleagues on the force were involved? Because
we always thought they were. Most of them are dead today. But still, all of that is, you know, rumor. Now, I'm sure there were policemen there that were Ku Klux Klan, and I think it gave them their ego some kind of, I guess, like the similarity to the urban gangs that you have today. There's just something about that attracts.
Jim, we're going to have to lose you here. We're coming to a break. Thank you for joining us, former police chief Jim Parsons. Connection
Thanks.
Listeners.
Bye, Chief.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, to join the Birmingham 1963 connection.
On Birmingham Sunday, the noise shook the ground, and people all over the earth turned around. For no one recalled a more cowardly sound.
Reserve your spot by calling 800-909-9287.
I'm Alex Beam. This is the Birmingham Connection with Diane McWhorter.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law.
That was President John F. Kennedy speaking on June 11th, 1963. It was just 2.5 months before the famous March on Washington, 3 months before the bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. And as long as we're making the sequence here, of course, it was barely half a year before his own assassination, which in a terrible way gave the subsequent president, Lyndon Johnson, the political momentum he needed to pass the landmark civil rights legislation of 1964. My guest in the studio is Diane McWhorter. She's the author of a new book called Carry Me Home, partly about her childhood in Birmingham, her hometown, during the years of the civil rights demonstrations and of the terrifying bombing at the 16th Street Church. Callers, to join the show, please call 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Alice, I know you've been waiting. You're on the line. Alice from Birmingham.
Yes, born in 1938 in TCI Hospital.
Wow. That's a U.S. Steel hospital.
I graduated from Birmingham Southern in 1959 and was right in the middle of a lot of the civil rights work. We met at the Unitarian Church and planned the integration efforts, and we also visited some of the White Citizens Council's meetings because we were being leafleted with leaflets about the normal inferiority of the black people. And, of course, we brought up some points as to why they were not, if you look at somebody's body. And we were told that they could not offer us any more protection if we didn't leave the meeting. So we were escorted from the meeting.
Alice, we had Reverend Shuttlesworth on earlier who was critical of the white churches. You were a 23-year-old woman. It sounds like maybe your church was in a different place.
In the Central Park Presbyterian Church, where I was brought up, we turned Reverend Somerville, our minister, out because he was preaching to us that the laws in our city were evil. And, of course, the excuse given was he didn't visit the sick enough, but he was kicked out of the pulpit for that reason. He tendered his resignation because he felt the hostility from the congregation. So then I went over. Of course, I was in a Methodist college, Birmingham Southern, but I visited the Unitarian Church and found out that there were a lot of social activists there who were Southern-born and bred, just like I was.
Yeah, when I was growing up, the Unitarian Church was considered sort of the communist hotspot in Birmingham.
Yeah.
So it was where all the activists congregated. And we,
that
of course,
is Birmingham there. Southern. We were pinko, hippie, liberal.
Right. That's where my grandmother was teaching at Birmingham Southern. Did you know her?
Yes, Ms. McWhorter.
Yeah.
I sure did. And actually, when my mother asked me after I was arrested for integrating the Woolworth lunch counter where she'd gone wrong, I said, "Mama, you took me to Sunday school. You never should have done that, because I actually believed what Jesus said about even as you do it to the least of these, my brethren, do you even so to me." But my point is that it wasn't the white trash that was responsible for this horrible iniquities done to the black people. It was my class, the educated middle class, who through the White Citizens Councils and through their tolerance and silence during these horrible times, they did nothing.
Alice, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Put us in the psychogeography here of Birmingham for a moment. Where was Diane McWhorter over the mountain? Was she in a different place physically than where you were?
No, not really, because many of us, for example, my great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, settled Shades Mountain in Hale Springs. He was from Mansfield, Massachusetts, by the way, so I've just come back home. But many of us were from the suburbs of Birmingham, and the idea was as you made it, you moved over the mountain. Well, in my case, I just moved back to Shades Mountain. But, we were living in the western suburbs.
Well, I do want to tell everybody that your position was incredibly brave and unusual for that era. I mean, it was, you know, it was a tiny minority who would risk life and limb to support the movement. So
well,
you were...
We were the worst of all because we weren't outsiders. We were their own homegrown folks, a southern liberal. And yet I must say that going to that wonderful liberal arts college, which the news report calls the number one liberal arts college in the Southeast, going to that college during Authoring Lucy's attempts to integrate the University of Alabama, we circulated a petition saying that we didn't care if she was purple. You know, anybody who could pass our entrance exams was welcome at Birmingham Southern. And Dr. Snavely, the chancellor at Southern at the time, said, "That petition better not ever reach my desk, or all of the people who signed it are going to be suspended." And so the next day, if you passed his parking place, somebody had hung a toilet seat over it. And by the way, it was the Ministerial Association who initiated that petition.
Alice, I want to hear briefly about your husband. What was he doing?
Oh, yes. He's dead now, but David Floyd is on is that famous picture of the fireman turning the hose on the... on the black people.
Mm-hmm. The one that I compare to the Iwo Jima, the shot of the Marines planting the flag at Iwo Jima. It's one of those sort of iconic photographs.
Number six on his helmet. And the strange thing is, because I was interviewed as a civil rights worker about this strange thing. Here's your husband. He's on the front lines keeping these people down, and you're a civil rights worker. But I have to tell the other side of that story. Holiday Beach was a beach out in Bessemer, Alabama, which is next to Birmingham. We were coming back one time, and two cars packed full of people had collided. And they had stacked a bunch of folks to the side of the road thinking they were dead. Well, David's a fireman. He's also an EMT. They didn't use that term then, but he's very acutely aware of how to resuscitate people. So he gets back there and starts going through the dead pile, as so-called dead, and finds several of them still alive, and he starts working on them. Everybody else is just standing around. And, of course, myself, the big liberal, was standing there also doing nothing. And so he gets he does first aid on them, and we get back in the car, and I said, David, you seem to indicate that you don't care for black people, that you'd join a Klan if you could find one that wasn't corrupt, and yet you were the only one helping folks back there. He says they're human beings, and when they're in trouble, you got to help them.
Alice, we're going to thank you for your call. Thank you for being there in 1963. It makes a difference. We have Julie on the line. Hello, Julie.
Hello?
Yes, you're with The Connection with Diane McWhorter.
Hi. I just wanted to speak, maybe not with tremendous knowledge, but with some knowledge about Birmingham today. I just moved back to Worcester, Massachusetts, having been in Birmingham for the last 10 years. And I was very surprised to find when I got up here, within a couple months, I read an article in one of the local papers about the fact that many black people who previously moved to the Northeast are now moving back down south again because they feel that there are more opportunities for them there, that there's more mobility, that they can reach a higher status there. And in fact, at the time that I spent in Birmingham, I felt that, yes, although there are still some people with firmly entrenched prejudices, as I think there are all over the country, that indeed many people have turned about in what their idea is and really want to make right and, give black people the opportunities to move upward. And in fact, the fact that there are so many black colleges, in the South has given black people an opportunity there to be educated in a way that they often are not able to up here where they're facing so much competition.
Well, thank you, Julie. Yeah, let's ask Diane about
that. Well, there is a huge black middle-class presence in Birmingham. Partly this is due to white flight, and there's City Hall is virtually all black now. So you have sort of, in Boston, historically, politics was how Irish were mainstreamed into the middle class, and now and we see the same thing in Birmingham through City Hall. But I think Birmingham, because of its past, also has a lot of institutionalized race relations, sort of communications going on.
Julie, can I ask you, Julie, you're still there, may I ask you very briefly, how is Worcester, the classical northern industrial mill town, compared to Birmingham?
Well, actually, to me, it's sort of interesting. Now, I've only been here a few months, but what I seem to notice is that there's a very white middle class that lives sort of on the foothills of the city, and that basically the black people, the Latinos, everybody that doesn't have is sort of concentrated in the center with very little in the way of resources. And in fact, I hazard to say that probably the conditions for a lot of the poorer people in Birmingham and Alabama, even though, for example, the education system is nowhere near as well-funded here, is probably better, I think, than it is here. I think that it shocked me because I feel like here there's just much more of a difference in class. And, people...
When you say here, you mean in Worcester.
In Worcester. And
right.
It's not that... It's that I could go about, all my life experiences and see very few black people unless I go down into the dead center of town and walk down the street, which wasn't my experience in Birmingham. In Birmingham, many of the places that I frequented had black employees.
Hmm. Well, thanks for telling us about that, Julie. Thank you for joining us. Connection listeners, the Birmingham, Alabama 1963 connection is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We have Joyce on the line. Hello, Joyce.
Hello. Just quick recollection, having been in Birmingham at that time, my mother, I recall her talking to Bull Connor, telling him she wanted to challenge the segregation ordinance by going to a black church, which a strict reading of the segregation ordinance wording would specifically not permit. And being apprehensive when she actually did that, police cars were there. Nobody was about to arrest the elderly widow of an Episcopal priest. But I went to also, Presbyterians were not uninvolved any more than the Unitarians were. I remember attending a meeting of a Koinonia group, reporting on a Koinonia group in a small Presbyterian church, and it was an integrated meeting, which was highly risky. And midway through the meeting, someone came up and said, the police are downstairs, they're going to arrest everybody here. And we were scrambling out the windows, and I got out the window, and the fellow I was with was lucky enough to be able to drive off, but there were police there taking down license plate numbers. And on my front porch the next morning, I recall the leaflet from the Citizens Council announcing this communist meeting having been held. And
thank you, Joyce. Right.
There's a cliche in Birmingham that there were no secrets from Bull Connor, and he did have this incredible network of spies in both the black and white community, so it doesn't surprise me that you would have these leaflets the next day on your doorstep.
Dan McWhorter, we want to give you the last word, and we want to ask you about a secret. You end a long, very beautifully written and very well-researched book with an incredible anecdote about asking your father, Daddy, what did you do in the Civil Rights Wars? Tell us about that.
Well, my father really cooperated with the book, and he sort of encouraged me to go on this journey of discovery, but he never would give me a straight answer about what he was doing. And finally, I took a tape recorder and went to his office and just tried to pin him down on it. And he was like, sort of, I came to think of him as sort of like Scheherazade, who would give me little crumbs and then keep me coming back for more. And he had led me to believe that he had knowledge of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. He once told me that he knew that Dynamite Bob Chambliss, the man who was convicted of the crime in 1977, didn't do it. And I said, how did you know? And he said, because I was with him that day. So I ended up going with him. And then when I was going through the Klan reports, I found the name of a Klansman named Loyal McWhorter. And my hands went clammy. I thought, oh, my God, he assumed this first name and this romantic first name. Anyway, when I finally confronted him on everything, it turned out he didn't know these Klansmen. And he didn't have any knowledge, and he wasn't involved. So,
well, I'm glad that at least that story has a happy ending. I have to take this opportunity to thank you, Dan McWhorter, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for coming back to Boston. Thank you for telling us about your book called Carry Me Home, about a fifth-grade girl in Birmingham, Alabama. Earlier during this hour, we were joined by the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, one of the co-founders of the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition, and by Jim Parsons, who was a policeman for Bull Connor and later became a progressive chief of police in Birmingham, Alabama. Thank you for being with us. I'm Alex Beam. This is The Connection.